Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. As the nation's mental health crisis deepens, psychedelics and other unconventional therapies are being used to treat debilitating depression and other mental disorders. And one of those drugs is ketamine, also known as Special K, a once popular club drug. Now it's being used for therapy that some call life-saving. Others are wary. The rise of telemedicine and looser regulations during the pandemic led to a perfect storm for an at-home, back-channel ketamine industry that operates outside the purview of the Food and Drug Administration. New York Times investigative reporter Chris Hamby spent months speaking to dozens of patients and medical professionals to understand the rapid growth of the ketamine business. A link to this article is at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Chris Hamby.
Thanks for having me on.
You have referred to this as a ketamine boom. Just how widespread is the use of this medication for mental health purposes?
It's a little bit difficult to track because a lot of this is off-label, so to speak. The kit was not approved for this purpose, so there's not a lot of great numbers on it, but it does some, at least looking at insured claims, we can know that it has doubled over a five-year period, and it's likely much more than that, tens of thousands of patients now using it.
What does the fact that it's being prescribed for or being used for unintended reasons and unintended purposes, what does that have to do with federal oversight of the drug?
So once a drug is approved by the Food and Drug Administration for one purpose, it can be prescribed at a doctor's discretion for other purposes. And the FDA has very little role in overseeing the actual practice of medicine. And this is not necessarily uncommon. Many drugs are prescribed off-label. In this case, it is a pretty different use for this drug, which was first approved in 1970 as an anesthetic. It actually was used to sedate and still sometimes is used to sedate patients during surgery. So a one-time higher dose use versus mental health treatment is what we're seeing now is lower doses, but longer-term regular use. It's a very different paradigm than what the FDA approved, and there's not a lot of oversight of that at this
and
point.
I'm trying to understand its club popularity, dance club popularity. What are the properties of ketamine and at the different dosages, and what makes it a party drug?
Well, so, I mean, the thing that some people like about it, and I have to say in speaking with patients, it is decidedly mixed. I mean, there's some people who find the effects actually quite terrifying and don't like it. But for people who do like it, it can engender sort of, it's almost like a psychedelic in some ways. It's technically considered a dissociative anesthetic, but it does have properties similar to other psychedelic drugs like LSD or psilocybin, the active ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms. And, you know, it can have hallucinations, sort of an out-of-body experience, this kind of a feeling of lightness, relief. A lot of times it engenders sort of a spiritual feeling in people, a sense of connection with the larger universe. And for a lot of, I think one reason that it's getting so much praise as a potential mental health treatment is that it does sort of seem to, at least temporarily, provide a sort of reset for the brain in which you may be sort of temporarily less emotionally affected by some of the things that are happening in your life. And you may be more receptive to therapy at that point.
When I read a lot about psychedelic therapy, psilocybin therapy, they talk about how it should be something that is very closely monitored for its therapeutic benefits, not for the party benefits, but it should be very closely monitored. You need to have a guide with you at the time and that sort of a thing. And but I'm not getting that from reading about ketamine, that it is as closely or it's not regarded in the same way.
Well, there's a couple different sort of treatment approaches here that are at somewhat at tension. And there's the more traditional psychedelic therapy approach, which is and this is what the research, really the early research into ketamine has looked at this sort of approach and found that it can be effective. And that is sort of a short time limited course of infusions These typically took place at a clinic of some sort, often under the supervision of a medical professional, and often in combination with some sort of therapy. And the idea is that it would not be something that you just sort of take indefinitely, but rather it would be something that sort of shakes up your brain for a period and sort of allows you to make positive changes in your life. What we've seen, and especially with the at-home use, is that some providers are treating it more as a purely something that has biological effects on your brain and doesn't necessarily, perhaps it is good if it is coupled with therapy, but doesn't necessarily need that. And that it's something you can just sort of take regularly for a period of time. And I think that is particularly untested, both in terms of the research of efficacy and perhaps more importantly in terms of safety, because we just, a lot of providers know that, well, you know, this has been on a drug that has been on the market since 1970. However, it has not been used in the way that a lot of providers are prescribing it right now for anywhere near that long. And we really don't know. Even the most sort of adamant boosters acknowledge that we really don't know what the long-term effects of taking this chronically for a long period of time are.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about ketamine this hour. Is the nation's mental health crisis deepens. Psychedelics and other unconventional therapies are being used to treat debilitating depression and other mental disorders, and one of those is ketamine. It's known as Special K, a once popular club drug. Now it's being used for therapy that some call life-saving. And I'm talking with New York Times investigative reporter Chris Hamby, who spent months speaking to dozens of patients and medical professionals to understand the rapid growth of the ketamine business. If you have a question or comment about it, if you use ketamine and want to join the conversation and tell us what your experience is, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Chris, you spoke with dozens of patients using ketamine treatments, and it really is impressive the way they say, even people who may be addicted to it at this point say, yes, but I'm still alive, and I wouldn't be if it wasn't for ketamine. What do we know about how it treats or what kind of therapy it is for extreme resistant depression?
That's the real promise here. I mean, that's the patient population that we're targeting with this. And that's something that kind of gets lost sometimes because some of these, particularly since at-home ketamine became available, a lot of sort of Silicon Valley startups or you know, sort of ambitious startup companies have marketed this pretty aggressively as potentially useful in a wide range of circumstances. The original promise of this, though, really was this is not really a first-line treatment at this point. This is something, at least right now, intended for people with treatment-resistant depression and other mental health disorders like that, that really have, they're intractable. They haven't responded to other more traditional treatments and therapies over a period of time. And so, you know, a lot of the people that I spoke with are really, really some of the people with some of the most challenging mental health issues. And, you know, so for them, the risk benefit calculation is a little bit different than you would have for your sort of, you know, the average patient who comes in with depression or anxiety.
Is ketamine, so if somebody happens to fall in with one of these online operators, they're going to push ketamine, or are they going to, in their consultation with the patient, say, well, let's first try, you know, whatever antidepressant is out there? Are they doing that, or are they going straight to ketamine?
Well, that's kind of one of the issues that a lot of people have with some of these telehealth companies, is that they primarily exist to prescribe ketamine. I mean, it is very, very clear from their marketing that that is what they do. If you are after a more traditional form of treatment, this is, you probably don't want to go to one of these providers. Now, they all do screen patients, and they say that, you know, they ensure that that ketamine treatment is appropriate for patients before prescribing it. But I, you know, obviously I spoke with a number of patients who described a somewhat less than rigorous screening process. And obviously these companies, you know, their business model is to prescribe ketamine. So, you know, that's what their sort of default position is in a lot of cases.
What's the trajectory for someone who becomes dependent on ketamine in some way? They're taking it's working. Why do they take more?
Well, the issue with ketamine, like other drugs that can develop a dependence, is, and this is really the thing with ketamine, is that if we do, in this case, it's not just a case where, you know, there's just total uncertainty about its long-term uses and potential downsides, but we know from studies where in certain parts of the world, especially the UK, Southeast Asia, Hong Kong, it has been abused. And so we know that it can, in some people, cause addiction, not necessarily the same sort of addiction that you might have with an opioid, but and then it can cause serious bladder damage. So we know that these things can occur at higher doses taken over a long period of time. So the question is just what the threshold is for who will actually develop these problems. And so, you know, you do develop one of the concerns with this sort of newer treatment paradigm in which people are taking it more regularly at home, is that you will develop a tolerance, which is something that is known with ketamine, to where you need more and more of it to achieve the same sorts of therapeutic effects. And the problem with that is that as you escalate the dose, you increase the risk for side effects, including the bladder damage and just risk of dependency.
Yeah, the bladder damage sounds horrible, and it's pretty common.
It's really hard to say at this point how common the bladder damage is. I mean, it certainly is something that in studies of people who abuse the drug is not uncommon.
Okay.
Now, people who, you know, a lot of medical providers today feel like it is very uncommon when you are using it medically. I think that that is really an open question. And I will say that I spoke with, you know, more than 10 of the patients that I spoke with experienced various forms of bladder problems. And there is a very active Reddit forum of people who use this therapeutically. And this is something that is getting quite a bit of attention on there. And in other, you know, there are Facebook groups and other online groups of medical providers who prescribe this, who are becoming, I'm told, increasingly concerned because they are seeing patients who are taking this as prescribed developing bladder problems. Now, in a lot of cases, this is not particularly severe and can resolve with cessation of use or just even sometimes scaling back the dose and frequency, but it can be a very, very serious permanent problem if not addressed early on.
Why is ketamine a problem for the bladder? Can you talk about that? Or,
I mean, I think there are various studies sort of looking at the exact mechanism by which it damages the bladder cells, but it is something that I think most people will acknowledge is one of the primary risks of using too much ketamine or too frequently. And a number of patients are seeing urologists. I spoke with some urologists about this who are pretty concerned and have helped develop sort of protocols to help prescribers, you know, reduce the risk for their patients so that they can still get the benefit of having the ketamine treatment without causing any sort of long-term damage for their patients. And it's particularly difficult in this case because it is being used off-label without any real federal oversight. And there's not a lot of reporting of this, and there's not really any sort of treatment standards at this point. So it's left to a lot of these groups to sort of cobble together ad hoc guidance by themselves and sort of rely on providers to reach out, get connected, and find the best information, which is obviously a very difficult thing for people to do.
One of the categories of providers are compounding pharmacies. You wrote a lot about that in the article and how they're helping to drive the supply. What are they and how do they operate in this regard?
So compounding pharmacies are sort of an alternative to traditional drug manufacturers, or when a patient can't, either an approved prescription drug for some reason doesn't meet a particular patient's need. Maybe they have an allergy to one of the ingredients in it, or they are not able to swallow a pill, and so they need, a suppository form or some other form. And so the compounding pharmacies are there to sort of make a special formulation of that in a lot of cases. And they were originally granted a lot of exemptions from regulatory rules about, reporting and quality control, because, generally these are things that would affect a fairly small number of patients and would be responding to, a few patient prescriptions. What has happened is that some of these compounding pharmacies have gotten significantly larger, and they are, shipping to states throughout the country. And they really have, I'm told, in this ketamine space, seen a real business opportunity, because this is one area where there is the only FDA approved form of ketamine. It comes as a liquid in a vial that, your anesthesiologist would draw up and give to you during surgery. But the doctors generally are not willing to prescribe that for a patient to send them home with a vial and a bunch of syringes to use ketamine at home, because there's severe risks with that. So these compounding pharmacies are really the only option for the at-home treatment. And so they will formulate this into, most of the time, it's either a tablet that rapidly dissolves under the tongue, or a sort of a lozenge that dissolves in the cheek or under the tongue. And so they're sort of the only game in town on this. And so this has been, the at-home ketamine has been a very big opportunity for this industry.
Since I read your article a few weeks ago, I kind of feel like I'm noticing more compounding pharmacies popping up, but I don't know whether it's my imagination or not, but is the ketamine, the demand for ketamine, creating some kind of growth in the compounding industry?
I mean, I think it's one of the things that is driving the growth. They also, sort of the more typical fare of compounding pharmacies is sort of dietary supplements and things like that. But yeah, it certainly is a growing business in that space.
Well, Chris Hamby, investigative reporter with the New York Times, thanks so much for your time and thanks for your great work. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
You bet. We're going to talk more about ketamine. We're going to hear from a Dr. Gerard Sanacora. He's director of the Yale Depression Research Center and leader of the team that pioneered the discovery of ketamine as a treatment for depression. So stay with us. And if you want to have a question or comment, want to tell us your story, 614-915. I'm sorry. Oh, my gosh. 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 MBR News.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast, White Lies.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. As the nation's mental health crisis deepens, psychedelics and other unconventional therapies are being used to treat debilitating depression and other mental disorders. One of those drugs is ketamine, also known as Special K, a once popular club drug, now popular for its effect on severe depression, otherwise resistant to FDA-approved antidepressants. Up to one-third of people suffering from major depression fall into that category. Dr. Gerard Sanacora is director of the Yale Depression Research Center and leader of the team that pioneered the discovery of ketamine as a treatment for depression. Welcome to the show, Dr. Sanacora.
Nice to be here.
How? What led to the idea that ketamine could be used in this way?
So actually, the research leading to ketamine's use as an antidepressant was not related to what most people think. It was research that had been done showing that the glutamatergic neurotransmitter system seemed to be involved in the pathophysiology of depression and other neuropsychiatric disorders. So it was really evidence from preclinical rodent work and from work of years of studies showing that other systems beyond the serotonergic system may be involved. And that's really what spurred the initial interest in looking at ketamine, which is a drug that targets the glutamatergic neurotransmitter system as a potential antidepressant.
So tell me about this glutamatergic system and what ketamine's doing to it.
So glutamate is the major neurotransmitter in the brain, meaning the major chemical messenger in the brain. So most people have heard of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. That's where most antidepressants have traditionally targeted. Glutamate is actually the most abundant, ubiquitous neurotransmitter, chemical messenger in the brain. And it's known to regulate a thing that we call neuroplasticity. So it really regulates to a large extent, the way the cells are communicating with each other in the brain and changing those connections. The other neurotransmitters do it, but glutamate does it much more directly and with a much greater influence. Ketamine is a drug that actually modulates it in a very complex way. It blocks one of the receptors for glutamate, but by blocking that one receptor, it actually causes more glutamate to be released. So it's very complex. It's not as simple as we'd like to say it lowers glutamate, increases glutamate. It has a complex interactive effect.
Okay. And so what about that effect affects depression?
Yeah. So therein lies the big question. The hypothesis that the original studies were based on was the idea that modulating the system could protect against some of the effects of stress and some of the damage that that may cause, but also lead to increases in neuroplasticity, or in other words, making the brain more adaptable to changes. That was the hypothesis it's based on. Since then, we've learned a lot more, and like most things in the world, it's probably much more complex than a simple one pathway that's affecting this.
There are also, you know, researchers are studying the use of LSD, of psilocybin from so-called magic mushrooms, that kind of a thing. Are they operating in the things they're looking at in those kinds of therapies the same thing as ketamine?
So the real answer is, and we don't really know.
Okay.
We do know that the landscape in how we treat depression has changed dramatically. Prior to ketamine, it was really just accepted that it takes weeks, if not months, to have antidepressant-like effects. And it was really thought that it was the serotonergic system that was primarily responsible. Now the landscape has changed dramatically. We have several antidepressants or several treatments that seem to have very rapid onset of antidepressant effect. Ketamine, for one, possibly the psilocybin and some of these psychedelics, but also some brain stimulation pathways, and even drugs as variable as allopregnanolone, which is a neurosteroid. So we're starting to see that there may be different pathways. Whether they converge on one common pathway, we don't know, or whether there's large nonspecific effects that mediate some of these, meaning effects beyond the simple pharmacology that are actually having this impact.
And a lot of this research that you're looking into, the questions that we're asking are a function of the expanding field of neuroscience, right? It seems like when I started this show about, you know, going on 14 years ago, it was just starting to get to the level where a show like mine would be talking about it. And it's fascinating because most of us grew up, a lot of us, you know, boomers grew up thinking that if you mess with your brain, that's it. No take backs, no second chances. Neuroplasticity tells us that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think the 1990s were the decade of the brain. I think it's taken about 30 years for that to translate into the decade of mental health. We've learned a lot from neuroscience, and now we're really just trying to understand how to apply that to mental health. And we still have a long way to go. And a lot of these discoveries, I always say, understanding the neurobiology puts you in the right haystack, but you still need some luck and serendipity to actually find the needle. And that's where we are right now.
People who respond to ketamine and are otherwise resistant, their depression is resistant to other more familiar drugs that deal with different aspects of the brain. Do they have a different kind of depression? Is it depression that you're treating, or is it something different?
So that's a great question. I think I would bring that back a little bit by saying, you know, we have this idea that depression is a unified homogeneous illness, and it's not. By definition, depression is what we call a diagnosis of exclusion. It means you have this set of symptoms, but we can't find a reason for it. So depression itself is a very heterogeneous, meaning there's probably many different pathologies, many different pathways that can take you to what we currently call as depression. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to find a simple way of separating who is more likely to respond to one treatment or another. It really is a major emphasis in the field, and much research is being done, but we're not at the point yet where we can really say, oh, this type of depression is most likely to respond to a certain type of treatment. We have some clues, and we can hedge our bets in one way or another based on that, but nothing as definitive as we'd like.
Are there ongoing studies about that are accumulating data on long-term outcomes, side effects, addiction risk, that kind of a thing?
So yes, for ketamine, there are actually some very good studies. And we talk about ketamine, but ketamine exists in different forms. Without getting too deep into the organic chemistry, you know, we talk about ketamine. It contains both what we call S-ketamine and R-ketamine. Together, that makes up what we call racemic ketamine. The FDA has approved a version, S-ketamine, delivered intranasally. And for that treatment, there is a huge amount of data. People have been followed for up to 4 years receiving this with very good data collected. And we do know quite a bit about the safety and the long-term efficacy of that treatment. For the other forms of the treatment, we know less, and largely because there hasn't been an organized data collection format for people to really put all their learnings together.
So I said earlier that you pioneered, you're part of a team and leader of the team that pioneered the discovery of ketamine as a treatment for depression. What suggested to you that this might be hold promise in the first place?
So first, I'd like to just back up a little bit and say I don't think I can take responsibility for being leader of the team the whole time.
That's what they told me.
Yes, I would not want to take that responsibility that honor at all. No, it was several of my colleagues at Yale really initiated that first study. People like John Crystal, Dennis Charney, Rob Berman were involved in that very early study. And what led them to undertake that, as I mentioned, was the accumulating research suggesting that the glutamatergic neurotransmitter system seemed to play a critical role in the pathology of depression. And the fact that it seemed to be more a cortical illness than the brain regions that predominantly are involved in serotonin and norepinephrine. So it really, as I mentioned, sometimes the science can lead you to the right haystack, where they had this idea that glutamate may play some role.
Okay.
And then having this drug that had been available, ketamine you spoke about, but ketamine has been an anesthetic approved by the FDA since 1970. It's one of the major anesthetics used throughout the world. So there was this drug that was available that we knew targeted, or they knew targeted the NMDA glutamate receptor. They had this hypothesis, and they tried a very small study with just 8 people, data from 7 people where they gave it, not really knowing what to expect, but with those 7 people, saw this very dramatic and very rapid response.
You know, we were talking earlier about the reporting by Chris Hamby, investigative reporter for the New York Times, and the problems that have surfaced. I mean, it sounds like primarily because of how it's prescribed and the pandemic and how that created the surge in telemedicine as prescribers, and also the role of compound pharmacies. How are you feeling about what's happening out there with this unregulated use of ketamine?
A little anxious. You know, ketamine, we know, is an anesthetic. I mean, that's what it has been approved for since 1970. If we give you enough ketamine, we can perform surgery on you. I mean, we know that this is a drug that has some real concerns. Some of it, as I said, is the, you know, the actual fact that it can completely sedate you and act as an anesthetic, but it has large effects on blood pressure, heart rate, things that can put certain people at real risk. It also has pretty dramatic effects on people's mood and cognition, changes their perceptions and cognitions. It's part of the reason some people may misuse the drug. So we know that could be dangerous for somebody at home, you know, to have these large changes in mental status that aren't observed by a mental health professional. And then the third, you know, or the other level of concern is more for society, that this drug with the potential for abuse could really be misused if it gets out of control. And, you know, right on the heels of the opiate epidemic, we just want to be careful. It doesn't have the same addictive qualities as the opiate drugs, but we do know it's a drug of abuse and something we need to watch carefully.
What's the difference between a drug of abuse and one that has addictive qualities? Where do you draw the line?
So that's a great question. And it isn't really so easy to do that. So and these addictive qualities kind of come on a spectrum. Drugs like the opiate drugs have a very large amount of physical dependence. So after taking opiates just for a short period of time, your body can become very dependent on it. And in the absence of the drug, have significant withdrawal symptoms. Ketamine doesn't really show that type of response, but we do know for whatever reason, people do enjoy taking it and will actually seek it out despite penalties for its use. And so we do know it's a drug of abuse. We know in some parts of the world it has become a major drug of abuse. So it's something we do need to watch carefully just because it doesn't have the same level of addictive, physical addictiveness as the opiates. It doesn't mean it's without risk.
You talked about the intranasal dosing of it. That's something that you have to go in-house for, right? You have to go somewhere to have that done.
So this is a very important point to get across. So the intranasal version of esketamine is the version that is approved by the US FDA. And after looking at all the data that was collected, and here's a case where there was very high quality, large volumes of high quality data that was collected in studies run by Janssen Pharmaceuticals to look at this, the FDA reviewed all that data, which would be consistent with what we would see with ketamine in general, and said, we approved the treatment, but they approved it with what's called a REMS, a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. So in order to mitigate the risk that we talked about with the drug, they said it's approved, but it has to be approved if it's given in a healthcare facility, witnessed by a healthcare professional. It has a very tight chain of command of what pharmacy will handle it, how it's given to patients, so it's not going to be taken at home, it's not going to be shipped places, and patients had to be monitored for a period of time. So the FDA approved the treatment, looking at all this, but they approved it with conditions. And by using this other version of it, it's kind of doing an end around a little bit, where since the FDA doesn't regulate it, it kind of takes all those mitigative strategies away.
The what you just described that the FDA has approved sounds expensive. Is that and can you talk about the role of pricing in all of this? If people just can't afford it, insurance companies, I don't know if they cover it. What's going on that score?
So you have a great point there. And this is really the balance. And it's the balance we always face in medicine between the struggle between access and doing what's best in medicine, or safest. I can't even say what's best, but what's safest. And here's a real struggle where what the FDA has reviewed, and according to their risk evaluation mitigation strategy, it puts a lot of requirements that cost quite a bit of money. And it does raise the cost of this to the point that some people cannot afford this. Insurance companies, for the most part, you know, and it's very regional, it's extremely regional, and it's even based on individual providers and individual health centers, will cover it for, at least in our area, in our hospital, most insurance companies cover the FDA-indicated version. Some will cover the other version, but it's quite limited. Outside of our region, you know, each state is unique, and each area within each state has its own regulations. It does make it very hard to get. Out-of-pocket cost is very expensive for this treatment.
Dr. Gerard Santacora, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope it's helpful.
It is. Dr. Gerard Santacora is director of the Yale Depression Research Center and part of a team that pioneered the discovery of ketamine as a treatment for depression. We'll continue our conversation, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. As the nation's mental health crisis deepens, psychedelics and other unconventional therapies are being used to treat debilitating depression and other mental disorders. And we're talking today about the increased use of ketamine as a treatment for depression, otherwise resistant to FDA-approved antidepressants. The issues of scant oversight and abuse remain. Dr. Adam Levine is a resident in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State School of Medicine and an affiliate scholar at the Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education in the College of Social Work. His research and clinical interests include the therapeutic applications of psychedelic drugs in the treatment of addiction and in veterans with PTSD. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How much are you talking about this ketamine issue in your scholarly circles?
Well, so I think it's something we think about a lot, specifically the benefits and risks of the compounds and drugs that we're working with. We recently did a survey of psychiatrists looking at their opinions about different drugs, including ketamine and different psychedelics and alcohol. And so we're always thinking about risks and benefits when we're kind of assessing these treatments.
The field seems much more open-minded. Maybe it's been open-minded for a while, but it's been the other regulatory pieces that are falling into place now?
I think it's a number of things. I think it is regulatory. I think culturally we're a bit more open to some of these treatments than we were even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then I think the data is just incredibly promising for a lot of these treatments. We're at a place in psychiatry where we're stuck for a lot of different disorders and a lot of areas. And so any new promising treatments are going to gain a lot of momentum.
I'm interested in understanding better this level of depression that is resistant to other drugs. Is it resistant because, well, I guess tell me why, what we know about why it's resistant. And I know it's, as my previous guest, Dr. Santacora, said, it's a continuum. There is a lot of iterations of depression out there.
Yeah, I think it's complicated. I think, and I think he might have mentioned this, what we're calling depression is a vast number of different things. It's a heterogeneous disorder. There's not one clear thing that makes it depression. I think people are depressed for a variety of reasons. Some people can have more of a biological form of depression where it's sort of strikes out of the blue.
Others, runs in the family, that
right,
kind of a thing.
Right, genetic. Mm-hmm. Others can have more, you can identify a specific cause. And then there's just a variety of things in between. So I think it's largely unknown.
What has the lack of regulation around controlled substances, what kind of effect has it had on, I guess we can look at the opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we think that this realm of healthcare is extremely regulated. We don't mm-hmm. think of what we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the problems that's emerged since the Controlled Substance Act, which puts drugs into these schedules, right? Schedule one drugs have no, you know, medical use supposedly, and are the highest risk for abuse, highest risk for addiction.
But THC's in that.
Correct. And so I think one of the problems is that drugs like that we study at the center, LSD, psilocybin, which actually have a very low risk of addiction, they are actually anti-addictive in a lot of animal studies. And then in human studies, they're rated as the highest risk. And so they have the really strict regulations that prevent people from being able to study them. They have trouble getting funding from the NIH. And other drugs, for example, benzodiazepines and opiates, are in lower risk categories. And that comes with somewhat less regulation, and there are more loopholes to be exploited. And so I think one of the problems is that the, and I think this is reflected by some of our research, the risk categories and the abuse categories don't match up with the actual drug schedule in a lot of cases.
How do you study these drugs?
So there's a lot of approaches. One way is through animal models, which are not perfect, right? Because can a mouse really be depressed or have OCD?
Tell you about it.
Correct. Right. And so one way is through, for addiction, for example, you put a mouse in a cage, you allow it to self-administer a drug. So you put cocaine, for example, in the water bottle and see how often it will go back. So you can use animal models. That's one way. Another way is survey data, just surveying populations of people who use drugs and see how many convert to a full substance use disorder. And then you can study drugs directly by administering them to people in a laboratory setting or in a treatment setting. So there's a lot of different kind of approaches to assess risks and benefits.
When it comes to something like ketamine, Dr. Santacuro was telling me about how it's well studied and it's FDA approved, this intranasal process, but it's also an in-house thing. You have to go in, be with a clinician of some sort, and they are with you when this happens. Mm-hmm. Why is that important?
So I think that's critically important. And I think not only is it important with ketamine, but it's important for a lot of the drugs that we're studying at the center, like psilocybin and magic mushrooms and LSD. We view this as a complementary package with therapy. So you're administering the drug as an adjunct to psychotherapy, and people generally have deep insights, really meaningful experiences when they're given in this setting. So we prepare people therapeutically over many hours. We administer the drug with a supportive environment and therapist, and then we have integration following the therapy, following the drug administration. And so these are all important components. And I think that the research is beginning to show that each one of those components is critical to positive therapeutic outcomes.
Impact on people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, has been remarkable, right?
That's correct. MDMA, which is psychedelics, is a sort of broad term. MDMA is a little bit different action than LSD and psilocybin, which are known as classic psychedelics. MDMA is what's known more as an empathogen through the term empathy. But that's shown incredible promise in PTSD and is actually in phase 3 trials, potentially for approval within the next few years.
The idea with these therapies is not necessarily that you do it forever. It helps trigger some longer-term response you're working with.
That's correct. And I've come to view it as unlocking sort of an internal healing potential, almost an immune response that's latent or suppressed. So it allows the person to begin to heal themselves. So it is, I would like to think of it as sort of a 1 or 2 treatment process that starts a longer therapeutic process. Now, I think people with ketamine may need multiple treatments, and that may end up being true of psychedelics as well. But a lot of the studies are looking at 1 or 2 administrations in the context of this larger therapeutic, 8, 9, 10 sessions.
Right. I've read from people, I think with LSD, they said it's been 4 or 5 years and they haven't wanted more, but they're still feeling the positive effects of it.
That's correct. I think some of the earliest studies in patients with cancer at the end of life, many of them, after a year of receiving the treatment, were still reporting reductions in anxiety and depression and positive impacts in quality of life. And that was following one or two sessions with therapy, and that was about a year later.
We were talking earlier about the role of neuroscience and the advancements in neuroscience because of the scans they're able to do on a living brain, and that we can see it. Do you spend a lot of time in front of a screen looking at brains?
I do not currently.
Okay.
I spend less time doing that. I'm interested in that, and I incorporate it in the way I'm thinking about these treatments. But one part of the treatment that I'm quite interested in is the correlation between the subjective effects. So the patients reporting these really positive, mystical type, insightful experiences and outcomes. And it seems like the higher they rate those insights, the more powerful the experience was, the better the outcomes in depression, PTSD, and other areas.
What are these drugs? I know have a very different effect on different people for different reasons, but what are they unlocking, in our brain?
It's really early days, and I think, you know, for me to say that I know for sure, that anyone knows for sure, it's so early, but I think
what are the hypotheses out there?
I think some of them are that in our day-to-day functioning, we kind of walk around with prior expectations, and the brain kind of is a top-down, it kind of regulates our day-to-day experience, and I think a lot of people can get stuck in those prior expectations. For example, in addiction, someone is stuck in this experience of, I want this drug or I want this thing. And in depression, it may be more self-referential. I'm not good enough, or I can't get things done. And I think what psychedelics may do is release people, and I think this is supported by some of the neuroimaging data as well, release people from those assumptions, those top-down, we would call top-down priors, and allow them to explore a new landscape of possibilities. So that voice or that trench they've been stuck in is released. And in the context of therapy and drugs that are synaptogenic, meaning they can create new synapses, that can be really powerful.
Are there other conditions, mental health conditions, that you're interested in learning more about how they might respond?
I think for me, so we're about to start our study in veterans with PTSD using psilocybin, and that's one that I'm really interested in, because veterans are particularly challenging. Their PTSD seems to be more resistant to treatment than other forms of PTSD. And then just addiction, I think really promising data for psilocybin assisted therapy and addiction.
Like triggering them out of it, getting, okay. Interesting. I was wondering about things like OCD, other kind of mental health struggles.
Definitely. And OCD, again,
obsessive compulsive disorder.
Correct. And OCD, again, would fall in that category of something where people are kind of stuck in a repetitive way of thinking. And there is data. There have been studies and expanding studies looking at psilocybin assisted therapy for OCD. And it's quite promising.
Dr. Adam Levine, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Adam Levine is a resident in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Health at Ohio State University School of Medicine. He's an affiliate scholar at the Center for Psychedelic Drug Research and Education in the College of Social Work. That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to the All Sides staff as well. My producer, my senior producer, Marcus Charleston. Our other producer, Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz. Intern producers, Chantel Brown, Chris Corcoran, Ethan Miller, and Nicole Nowicki. Hope you had a good spring break. With video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director, Mike Thompson. Radio Operations Director, Kevin Petrilla. And Senior Broadcast Technician, Eric French. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.